the week of June 19th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 108, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing good, Sperling. How was your daughter's graduation?
Very good. She graduated from kindergarten, not from high school or college.
She made it.
Yes, she's made it.
She learned to tie her shoes.
Don't get me started.
Okay. Well, I had a good weekend. I saw Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, finally.
Really? Well, we're actually going to be talking about that on today's show. We're going to be trying to decipher exactly how next year's Best Picture Oscar nominees will be chosen. I'm still a little baffled myself by the whole scenario, and I'm hoping, Michael, you can help me untangle the whole thing.
Untangle, just like Spider-Man. I think I got it. I think I'm on top of it.
Okay. There are more rumors about Spotify's pending U.S. launch as Pandora decides to go for a wild ride on Wall Street. They went public last week. As you mentioned, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark finally opened on Broadway last week, just in case you haven't heard, because it was all the news last, I guess, Tuesday and Wednesday. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and we have a ton of Big Deal or Big Whoop stories. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, we have the figures for the worldwide box office this weekend. The number one movie around the world was Green Lantern, which opened at $69 million worldwide. Most of that came in the U.S., where it also opened at number one at $52 million. Kind of soft in a lot of ways compared to a lot of other comic book movies. Not a disaster, but given the terrible reviews and the what looks like bad word of mouth, it probably will fall hard next week. So, you know, we've got to wait and see how it does in a week or two, but it doesn't look great for Green Lantern. At number two worldwide is Kung Fu Panda 2, which grossed another $61 million worldwide. It's at $423 million total so far. At number three worldwide was Super 8, the J.J. Abrams film that grossed $33 million around the world. It's at $94 million total so far, which is great for a film that only costs $50 million to make. At number four is X-Men First Class, which grossed $32.7 million worldwide. It's at $283 million and counting. At number five, probably the biggest news at the box office, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides grossed another $32 million. It's at $952 million worldwide. It broke all sorts of records this weekend. It's Disney's biggest overseas grosser of all time. It's past $900 million. It's about to enter the billion-dollar club. It will become one of only eight movies in history to have grossed more than $1 billion worldwide.
And you can almost guarantee a Pirates 5 because of that.
Unless Johnny Depp is wildly bored, yes, there will be a Pirates 5. Just like there will be a Hangover Part 3, because the Hangover Part 2 grossed another $32 million. It's at $488 million worldwide, just under half a billion dollars, still going strong. It's the highest R-rated comedy, blah, 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 in history, et cetera, et cetera. At number seven is a debut film. It basically opened in North America only. It's Jim Carrey's Mr. Popper's Penguins, a family film. It grossed $18.7 million, with just a couple hundred thousand of that coming from overseas. People are acting as if Jim Carrey's career is over, but we'll get more to that later. At number eight, Bridesmaids. Yes, there will be a Bridesmaids 2. This grossed $14 million. It's finally starting to open overseas, mainly in Australia and New Zealand this weekend. It's at $144 million worldwide, most of that coming in the U.S., big success story. And number nine is Woody Allen's movie Midnight in Paris. We don't have all the figures from overseas yet, but it's grossed at least $5.7 million worldwide this weekend. It opened in the U.S. wider than it's ever been before, over 1,000 screens. That's a record for Woody Allen for any movie he's done in his entire career. It's grossed about $42 million worldwide and counting.
Talk about a success story. That is a success story.
It's still far off the pace of Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Not off the pace, but it's still well below Match Point and Vicky Cristina Barcelona. We'll have to see if it matches them. Those made $75 to $90 million worldwide. So he's been doing this in the last decade. He has had success like this before. And at number 10, opening overseas only, is the Cameron Diaz, Justin Timberlake comedy, Bad Teacher, which opened basically in the UK. It grossed $3.4 million. And that's a good start for a movie that's opening in the U.S. this weekend.
Yeah, it's surprising that they opened that film in the U.K. first. So I would have...
There's sure some quirky reason why.
Well, I'm sure that there was a holiday or something that made the studio open that film overseas first.
Absolutely. So the U.S. box office and the worldwide box office match themselves pretty directly, though, of course, some movies are higher up worldwide than they are in the U.S. Green Lantern opened on 71 screens in 3D. 71% of their screens were in 3D. Only 29% of their screens were in 2D. But those were the screens people went to. Not only were people not wildly enthused about the movie, they sure as heck were not interested in paying a premium to see Green Lantern. So only 45% of its business was done in 3D. We've seen that a lot lately. They're not even breaking 50% in their opening weekend. If people wanted to see the movie, they did not want to pay a lot to do it.
Well, you're right. I mean, we're seeing that on movies like Kung Fu Panda 2, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. Thor was at 60%, but for 2,711 screens showing it on 3D at 71%, you would have thought that the percentage of the gross that was 3D would have been somewhere in the 50, 55, 60 range, and it just wasn't.
Right. Though Pirates, of course, one big reason it's doing great overseas are the 3D screens that you see internationally in China and elsewhere. People have not gotten sick of 3D yet in the rest of the world the way we are in the U.S. So that is one reason why Pirates and Kung Fu did as well as they did.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But here in the U.S., Green Lantern actually dropped Friday to Saturday, 22%. That's a lot.
That's not wildly uncommon, especially since Friday included the Thursday numbers, but it is a serious drop. If it had gotten good word of mouth, it might have increased Friday to Saturday or something like that. But yeah, there's no question that the reviews were terrible. The audience polling was poor. It's, you know, Ryan Reynolds, it's his biggest opening, you know, obviously a starring role yet. And the jury's still out, but it doesn't look promising for the second weekend and beyond. The movie cost $200 million to make. I'm sure it'll make $200 million worldwide, and so nobody will lose their shirt. But it's going to be a hard road to turn this into a success story.
Well, if it makes $200 million worldwide, you've got to cut that in half because 50% will stay with the theater. So then theatrically, it only would have made $100 million.
$100 million would have returned to the studio, but then they can look forward to cable and DVD and all that stuff to try and make up some of the shortfall.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically going to be breaking even on this, and they hope to break even on theatrical rather than breaking even on all, you know, everything.
Right. And in the art films, we were looking at, you know, the two big movies from Cannes, Midnight in Paris, which was a non-competition film. That's grossed $42 million worldwide. $12 million of that was in France alone. So wow. No wonder the French are willing to pay $5 or $6 or $8 million to the rights to a Woody Allen movie. He's a big, big draw in France. Terrence Malick's film, The Tree of Life, which won the top prize at Cannes, that has grossed $20 million worldwide so far. When you look at it in the U.S., it is ranked at number 12, I think. It grossed $1.1 million. It expanded to 114 screens, sort of what you would expect for a Terrence Malick film. He's not a big commercial draw. He's grossed $3.8 million so far in the U.S. on a movie that cost $32 million to make.
It's remarkable to me that somebody actually gave him $32 million to make a film that they knew would only make $35 million, if
we're lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, his top grossing movie of all is like, what, $40 million? Or I forget, we looked it up last week.
If he's lucky.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that the box office this week, the biggest, I don't know, telltale sign or bellwether for me was that there were lower opening grosses and attendance on X-Men First Class, Thor, The Incredible Hulk, and Fantastic Four. And what I mean by that, I should qualify that. Green Lantern had a lower opening gross and attendance than all of those films. And it had a lower attendance than Daredevil and Ghost Rider.
It sold fewer tickets and it made less money.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what you'd expect of a movie that doesn't get good reviews, isn't a big character, and, you know.
Well, that's really it, isn't it? That they're trying, they've kind of already done Spider-Man. They've already done all the big characters like Batman and Superman. And so now they're milking some of these B-list characters.
But Iron Man was also a B character. I mean, the problem is not that they made a movie based on Green Lantern. The problem was that they didn't make a good movie based on Green Lantern. Unless, of course, you think Green Lantern just wouldn't make a good movie in general.
Yeah, I can't really say. I'm not a really well-versed in the Green Lantern mythology.
Well, let's just say if Ghost Rider can make money, then there's no reason why Green Lantern couldn't.
And that's where I was headed with that statement. Thank you for saving my sentence there. Now, can you please save me again and explain to me what the heck the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences did last week with their new rules for nominating a Best Picture? Now, a couple years ago, they expanded the top five nominees for Best Picture to a top 10 list, and the Oscars now say the list will expand or contract depending on if it's raining in Detroit and whether it's sunny in Orlando, and I can't figure it out.
Well, it's not that complicated. All they instituted a new rule that they will have five or more films listed as the Best Picture nominee, but each film must receive at least 5% of the votes in first place, meaning at least 5% of the people who vote must say this is their favorite film of the year. So if everybody names the movie as their fifth or eighth favorite film of the year, and not enough people name it their number one pick, it won't make the list no matter how many points it gets. This is sort of eliminating The Blind Side or An Education, which is what it seems like from previous years. They want to make sure that if a movie makes the list that people are passionate about it. So all you have to do is get picked the best movie of the year by at least 5% of the voters. And they went back and they looked at the ballots to see what this would have meant in previous years. And they looked and they saw, well, this year it might have meant six films for Best Picture. Another year might have been eight. Another year, five. Another year, nine. So it's going to fluctuate year to year.
I noticed that it was never 10, though. I did note that.
That's right. They did say that it looked like there was no year in which 10 different movies all got at least 5% of the vote.
Yeah, they had the folks at the accounting firm, what was it, PricewaterhouseCoopers. They went back and did a blind survey and gave it back to the Academy and said, okay, here's, you know, from 2001 to 2000 and I think it was eight or nine.
I thought they just analyzed the ballots that have been turned in.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yes. So, yeah, I guess blind survey to us and to the Academy, but not to them.
Well, I'm saying they didn't go poll people again. They just reanalyzed the data that they had.
Yes,
they
correct.
If these rules had been in place, what would have happened?
Correct,
and
yeah.
Like the result, here's what it does. One, it creates an air of suspense. How many nominees will there be? How good was this year at the box office? I mean, you know, critically. Will there be five nominees, seven nominees, six, eight? We won't know until the morning they announce the Best Picture nominees. Then we'll find out exactly how many movies had passionate support. Two, there'll be fewer complaints about movies just filling in a slot to round out the top 10. Every movie on the list will have passionate support. Presumably, it'll still be an opportunity for a diverse, audience-friendly list. The whole point of expanding the list was to make sure they didn't drop off a movie like The Dark Knight, which sort of embarrassed them the year that movie was one of the most critically acclaimed films of the year, but didn't get nominated for Best Picture. So, you know, they figure at least 5% of the Oscar voters will pick The Dark Knight as their favorite movie of the year. Surely another 5% would pick, you know, Toy Story 3, something like that. The problem is that some of the negative stuff is it makes the rule changes feel so random and arbitrary. You know, we just changed these rules 2 years ago. Now they're changing them again. It's not consistent.
Right. But I mean, I think if you're going to do that in a way, when you make such a radical change, it's going from 5 to 10 Best Picture nominees. It's better to say, hey, things didn't work out. We made a change. The change didn't work. So we're noticing it sooner rather than later. And we're going to go back to the other way, or we're going to go back to a different way.
Well, that's what the Hollywood Reporter? The Hollywood Reporter had a story explaining why this experiment of the 10 best list failed. And their results and their conclusions, I should say, were, to me, confusing, arbitrary, contradictory, made no sense. I don't understand why anybody thinks it was a failure. Their reasoning given was, one, too many independent films made the list. You know, the list of 10 best pictures included movies like The Kids Are All Right and Winter's Bone in 2010. In 2009, it included the Joel and Ethan Coen movie A Serious Man and An Education with Carey Mulligan. And so studios were annoyed. They wanted the expanded list to include more studio films, and instead they were just seeing more indie films.
Right, which is what they were trying to get away from in the first place.
Well, that was the complaint, but maybe the studios don't like that, but it contradicts their next point, which is that cartoons made the list. People were annoyed that movies like Toy Story 3 and Up made the list of the 10 best films of the year. They have their own category. Why are they getting nominated for Best Picture? We only did it once before in history for Beauty and the Beast. Why? It's going to happen every year now, and that's so annoying. That was a complaint.
Well, I said the same thing. Not that they shouldn't be nominated. What I was saying is, given that there's a Best Animated Film category now...
Let's stick to the Best Picture nominees. Either you think that one of the best reviewed and most popular films of the year deserves to be on the Best Picture list, or you don't. I do. I don't care whether it's a cartoon.
Right. No, I as you know, I've studied animation, so I'm fine with it being in Best Picture, even if there's only five nominees.
So why then is that a problem that cartoons made the list?
It's not a problem that animated films made the list. My problem with it is because there was that animated...
You're raising a different issue about whether there should be a separate category for animated film.
No. What I'm saying is if Toy Story 3 is nominated for Best Picture and it's also nominated for Best Animated Film, what do you think it's going to win? In other words, the Best Picture nomination wound up being an also-ran. It didn't matter because you knew it was going to win Best Animated Film and everybody knew it was going to win Best Animated Film. So therefore, having it in the Best Picture category, It wasted the spot.
It's a problem that the expanded list included animated films.
Not at all.
All right. Do you think it's a problem that there aren't enough movies to fill the list? The next complaint was that Hollywood doesn't make 10 good movies a year. The Hollywood Reporter quoted one insider who said he talked to 60 people and only five of them could mention 10 films of the year that they thought were good. Most of them only had six or seven.
Well, maybe they should stop looking outside Hollywood.
Maybe they should watch more movies is my response. Then again, they said too many indies made the list. Then they said not enough big commercials made the list. There weren't more bigger studio films. Then they said dumb movies made the list, like The Blind Side.
That I agree with.
Well, right. But if you want big Hollywood movies to make it, one of the most popular films of the year with the best actress winner, Sandra Bullock, perhaps belongs on the list. You can't say it's a shame The Blind Side made it, and it's a shame indie films make it, and it's a shame cartoons make it. It's like, well, what do you want on the list? Your movie. I don't understand why these are criticisms of the list. I don't understand what was wrong with the 10 best list. Everyone understands it. Everyone gets it. Every film critic in the country does at least a 10 best list of the year. If you see a good number of movies, it's very simple to come up with 10 good movies. And I don't think the list that they came up with were embarrassing or bad. The only complaint I see that I can say, well, all right, so they say, well, ratings were down.
Well, and ratings were down because, let's face it, by the time the Oscars roll around at the end of February, early March now, everybody knows who's going to win because there's been 50 award shows leading up to it. There is no suspense anymore.
You knew Hurt Locker was going to win Best Picture?
Versus Avatar?
You knew Hurt Locker was going to win the Best Picture.
After James Cameron's I'm King of the World speech, yeah, I was pretty sure that it would win Best Picture. It would have been okay if Avatar won. I wouldn't have gone, oh my gosh, I can't believe Avatar won, because it was a groundbreaking film. But at the same time, it was...
So you didn't think there was any chance of Up in the Air starring George Clooney or Inglourious Basterds or even Precious as the... As the spoiler, you were convinced it was going to be The Hurt Locker. There was no suspense that night for you.
By the time it got to the Oscars, yes. Ask me earlier in the season, and I would have said, well, you know, it's going to be hard to beat Avatar.
Well, what's wrong with this list from 2010? The King's Speech, Black Swan, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids Are All Right, 127 Hours, The Social Network, Toy Story 3, True Grit, and Winter's Bone. To me, that's a mix of Hollywood and independent, massive box office successes, popular fare, independent fare that was critically acclaimed, independent fare that became huge box office hits like Black Swan and The King's Speech. I don't understand anybody's argument that this experiment was a failure.
Yeah, I would agree with you on 2010. You're absolutely right. All of those films were very worthy movies.
Well, I like them all. I mean, most of them weren't on my best of the year list. Well,
yeah, I wasn't a big fan of The Kids Are All Right, but yet I can understand why some people were.
Well, it was... absolutely an independent success story, one of the big word-of-mouth hits of the year. I didn't like Black Swan, but it grossed $300 million, was critically acclaimed, and a lot of people liked it.
Well, Patrick Goldstein had a point, and he writes for the LA Times, and in his column last week, he was saying, we understand that the Best Picture race, it's a great marketing tool for films that might need that little extra push to get audiences to go see them. So for films like Winter's Bone or The Kids Are All Right, great, they got that little extra bit of publicity. But it really, for the most part, always comes down to two or at most three films. It's Hurt Locker versus Avatar. It's King's Speech versus Social Network. It's never really, gee, it could be anybody's game. It's usually between two or three films.
That hasn't changed because of the list being five or six or seven or 10. That is true, that it usually comes down to two frontrunners, just like it does for the race for president or best drama on TV or anything. Doesn't change the fact whether you think, you know, this list is a good or bad idea.
Well, I'd like to see how the new rules work and see if it does add anything or whether it's just silly and they should go back to 10 or keep it at five.
I strongly disagree that there was a problem.
Oh, I don't think there was a problem. I didn't have a problem with it.
Well, they did. They changed it. They changed it after 2 years. They said, well, we're going to do it for at least 3 years. And they stopped after two.
Yeah, well, and as far as, you know, ratings being down, you know my feelings on that.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with this list.
Well, what did you think about the other list that the Academy made public?
The new people they're adding to the members?
Yes.
I have no thoughts about it whatsoever.
Well, every year, the Academy votes in people who get nominated to be in the Academy as voting members. So it's in groups like actors and animators and writers and cinematographers. And there are folks in the actors category that raised a few eyebrows, folks like Russell Brand, who was in Arthur and Get Him to the Greek.
Why would that raise an eyebrow?
Well, because I guess they're looking at it and going, what, the guy's been at it for a long time, but why does he get into the Academy for that? Whereas someone like...
No, I don't understand. Somebody said Russell Brand doesn't deserve to be a voting member of the Academy. He's been in, you know, a dozen plus movies and he's been in hit films. I don't like him, but what the heck? What do you mean? Why wouldn't he be in the Academy? It's not limited to people that are critically acclaimed. I mean, he's an actor. He's been in hit films. He's making a ton of movies. He's got 20 films to his credit. He's going to star in Rock of Ages. He was just an Arthur. He was in Hop, a big hit animated film. Despicable Me, get him to the Greek. He's a worldwide star. He's known all over the world. Why wouldn't he be in the Academy?
What about Jennifer Garner?
It's not. Well, why not? Of course, Jennifer Garner.
Okay, what about Beyonce Knowles?
Why not? If she's acted in a movie and is eligible, why not? It's not supposed to be just Laurence Olivier who gets to vote. If you're a working actor and you make movies and you're starring in major Hollywood films, I think you should be. I think the membership should be bigger. Why not? Of course they should be eligible.
Well, it's definitely getting bigger. And as a matter of fact, my kindergarten age daughter graduated from kindergarten today. And one of her classmates, one of her classmates' fathers, Jeff Small, who works over at DreamWorks, is the head of DreamWorks. He was voted in.
Oh, well, what's he do at DreamWorks?
He's the president of DreamWorks.
Well, why would he only be getting in now? I'm sure he didn't just start in the job this year. So what took them so long?
Well, same reason that Leslie Moonves over at CBS gets in now. He's the head of a television network, and he's now in the Motion Picture Academy.
Well, but yes, but CBS has been making films for years. They get released theatrically.
For the last 3 years.
Right. So as soon as you start making movies that get released in theaters and you're a major player, you know, it's not like he's an indie guy shooting films on his Super 8 camera.
No. And it's weird. Like people like Graham Revell, Terrence Blanchard, these are people that should have had been in the Academy years ago, you'd think.
Absolutely. It's bizarre. If you're in a film that gets commercially released by a major studio, you know, or you've got 5 credits to your name, I mean, it should be automatic.
Well, I guess really what it boils down to is a lot of people kind of flummoxed that folks like David Rabe, who is not only a great screenwriter, but also a great playwright, is just now making it into the Academy with someone like Mia Wasikowska, who's 21 or 22 years old.
Well, they both should be in.
Right. I guess the thing is, they felt like David Rabe, it's surprising he wasn't in already.
Well, I guess, how many films does he have to his credit if that's the issue? But I mean, as soon as you do, it seems bizarre that he wouldn't be. So they should get on the ball and get people in there quicker. The bigger the group voting, the better it'll be for everybody.
So you have a lot of problems with the Academy.
Well, if anybody's bitching about the fact that that Russell Brand is in the thing and they keep changing their minds about the top 10 list and how many movies should be nominated. David Ray's been doing screenplays for, 20 plus years. He did Streamers, the Robert Altman film, did Casualties of War, which is nominated for an Oscar. You know, if he did The Firm, Hurley Burley, based on his play, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, he should have been he should have been in the Academy, in the 80s.
Well, now, speaking of the 80s, the 80s is when I first heard about. I first heard about Bruce Springsteen in the early 80s. I didn't really know much about music, frankly, before 1980, and didn't really know much about Bruce Springsteen at all until Born in the USA. What about you?
The first album I bought from Springsteen was The River, and the first album of his I waited for and bought in the store. No, I'm sorry, it was actually Nebraska, strangely enough.
Okay.
That was the first Bruce Springsteen album I bought. Then I went back to The River, and then I bought everything, and then I hotly anticipated Born in the USA. So right around 82, I guess, in 81, 82 was Nebraska. So I'm probably one of the rare people to have that be my first Springsteen album. But certainly he's shot to worldwide fame with Born in the USA. I saw him on tour. And, of course, I fell in love with Clarence Clemens, which is why you're bringing this up. Unfortunately, he had a terrible stroke and then died shortly afterwards.
Yeah, died a week later.
Yeah, it's just I've seen Springsteen many times in concert. And his rapport with Clarence on stage, Clarence is such a magnetic personality, not the world's greatest saxophone player, but he made the most out of the chops he had. And their dynamic, their rapport back and forth on the stage was one of the big parts why the Springsteen experience in concert was so amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was a big part of the E Street Band, which backs Bruce Springsteen and has been, I guess, touring with him now since 1970.
And on and off.
Yeah, and recording records with him. And, I guess what Springsteen said with Clarence at my side, my band and I were able to tell a story far deeper than those simply contained in our music. His life, his memory, and his love will live on in that story and in our band. And that kind of was the first indication that, you know what, the band is going to go on without him. They might get a saxophonist to fill in.
No question about that. I mean, Springsteen took a decade off from the E Street Band and toured with other musicians. And I'm, you know, that was at the end of the 80s and through the end of the 90s when he was doing more solo, personal, strange stuff. And strange isn't the word I should use, but solo, quirkier stuff. And everybody else went their own ways. Little Steven was doing The Sopranos on HBO. Clarence had a brief solo hit and, you know, performed on other people's albums. But basically, they were there waiting kind of for, you know, they did studio work, I'm sure. But basically, they were there when he gave the call. They all came back again and started touring again. I'm just very delighted and happy that that break didn't happen when, you know, now. It would have been a shame if they'd been apart for a decade as far as touring together when Clarence died. It's very nice that we've had a full, you know, two decades really with them back together again. Oh, I should say about 13 years.
This is the second member that has passed away, the second member of the E Street Band. Danny Federici, the, I guess, keyboardist and organist, passed away, and now Clarence Clemons. But I was really surprised. It was a front page story in the LA Times and New York Times.
Well, you know,
and he's not Bruce Springsteen. It's not Bruce Springsteen, mind you. It's his saxophonist. And I guess Springsteen is so popular and so well known and so big around the world that even his saxophone player passed away.
Well, I would say even, because I don't think Danny Federici, God bless him, was front page news. Clarence was a big personality, very well known, and such a big part of their stage show. I think Little Steven would be very big news. God willing, he'll live many years to come. But, you know, those three are sort of the core of the Springsteen experience. And the band is, you know, one of the biggest live acts in the world. So it is big news.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw them last in 2008. I was in the first four rows. And then I noticed in 2002 when I saw him in a similar position that Clarence Clemons was getting old. He was 69 when he passed away and he wasn't in good health.
Oh no, he had a little chair on the side of the stage that he would sit down on every once in a while to rest during the shows.
Yeah, and he'd play like these little, you know, Christmas jingle bells.
That's right. He was definitely getting on in years, and the shows are, you know, incredibly taxing physically. I mean, they're two and a half, three hour shows. Springsteen is drenched in sweat by the end. Clarence was taking it easy at the end, God bless him.
Yeah. Well, it's a
Bruce Springsteen was not discovered by Nick Harcourt. But it is also big news in the music world that Nick Harcourt, the host of Morning Becomes Eclectic, which is a very big show on NPR, is departing KCRW.
Yeah, I mean, in LA, KCRW is the NPR station of note. There's also KPCC from Pasadena Community College. But this is the station that has gained some really world acclaim thanks to the internet. Morning Becomes Eclectic is one of its signature shows. And Chris Derides ran it for years. There was somebody before him that ran it for years. Derides went off and became a music supervisor. Nick Harcourt came in about 12 years ago, started filling in, or I guess 14 years ago he came in. And then in 2008, Harcourt said, you know what? I'm going to go and pursue my music supervision of films and television commercials and TV shows, and I'm going to do one show a week here at KCRW on Sunday evenings. Everybody thought, well, it's sad to see him go because he became widely known for promoting bands that were unknown, bands like Death Cab for Cutie, Franz Ferdinand, Vampire Weekend, Interpol, Black Keys. I think Arcade Fire was one of the bands that he helped bring up. And I guess that's what the station became known for throughout from 2000 to about 2010, even before 2000. And now I guess he was talking to some station at Cal State Northridge and he was going to do a little show once a week for them. And KCRW said, you know what? You have to choose. It's us or them. At the same time, he went off and was hired by MTV as an in-house music supervisor and A&R executive. So they just kind of, in a way, you know, made him choose between two stations and then made the decision for him, just announced that he was leaving.
MTV wants to get back into music?
Apparently. They actually want to sign unsigned artists.
So he's a notable figure in the industry. He's known as a tastemaker. Certainly NPR people know Morning Becomes Eclectic, which he was a big part of for many years. So moving on from KCRW is the end of an era for people, though he'd sort of faded away a bit there. So it's probably not that big a shock as it would have been in, say, 2008.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people feel, wait, didn't he leave already?
Shouldn't he get hired by Spotify or Pandora to help them spruce up their artist promotion?
Well, does Spotify and or Pandora actually need somebody to spruce them up? Because Spotify just says, we don't care who you are, we'll take your music and we'll stream it. The whole goal is throw a whole bunch of songs in one place and let people come and pay us $10 a month and you can play whatever you want.
So what's happening with Spotify? They are, of course, a very big company in Europe.
Right. They're huge in Europe. They have over 1 million paying members. And they have a freemium and a premium. So you can listen for free, but I think you can only listen for about 10 hours for free. Or there are certain rules about listening for free, and certainly you get some ads. Then they have this premium where you can just pick songs and listen to any one of millions of songs, and you pay $10 per month for that, or 10 euros per month. And Daniel Ek, the CEO, was able to raise $100 million on a billion-dollar valuation of the company from Kleiner, Perkins, and Accel, I guess a hedge fund.
Why is he raising $100 million? What's he going to do with it?
Well, I think boats, women, booze, drugs, and he may, don't quote me on this because, you know, these rumors are only running rampant, you know, over the past couple of weeks. I think he's going to launch in the U.S.
So this has been a long time coming. So the problem was that Spotify wasn't able to get licensing deals. Have they finally cleared those up?
Spotify now has deals with three of the bigger or biggest record companies here in the U.S. Warner Brothers is the holdout, and that deal is in advanced talks and probably was delayed by the fact that Warner Brothers is for sale or was sold.
Right. So Spotify's finally coming to the U.S. in July. We've been talking about it for a long time. They're very successful in Europe, but they're coming to the U.S. after Google and Amazon and Apple all give you mobile access to music you own and all these other subscription services. Is this too little too late?
I don't know. I mean, I've tried Spotify and it's actually quite amazing. But my question is this. I have XM radio for the car. I've got Pandora, which is free, where I can pay $29 for a year. I've got, you know, anything that's on iTunes, whether it's my own music or those radio stations that they have. I've got KCRW. Google, Amazon, and Apple, as you mentioned, the difference is they'll play music you already own, not music that you don't own, where Spotify can play and access millions of tracks. I just don't know if I need another music service. I don't need to pay another subscription.
Mm-hmm. And Pandora, of course, just went public, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And did you hear what happened to them when they went public?
They didn't exactly explode. Unlike LinkedIn, they didn't have a great day.
Right. They did not have a great day. And, you know, Pandora's never made a profit. And for those who don't know, this is the music streaming service that you can, you know, enter a song or an artist and they will place other like songs or artists next to them. It came out of the Music Genome Project, never made a profit, and they went public on Wednesday with a single letter ticker symbol. Just the letter P is their ticker symbol. That's very rare.
That wasn't taken already?
No.
Hmm.
And after upping its offering price to $16 from what was once $8, the stock rose to about the low 20s. And
going to confuse me with numbers.
Well, so it went from, like, you know, 16 to 24, then back down to 18 by the end of the day Wednesday when the day closed, when they went public.
No, it ended at $13.26.
That was Thursday, the very next day.
Oh, okay.
So on Wednesday, hey, everybody was up. Bought it at 16, it's now 18. The next day, it went for a ride and went below $13 and then back up to $13.26. And then if you ask some people, some Wall Street analysts like Richard Greenfield of BTIG, of course, we've talked about him before. He believes that after a year, the target price should be $5.50.
Why?
He just doesn't think that there's any there. He doesn't believe in the company or the stock.
But right now, the company is worth about $2 billion. For all the ups and downs, we're looking at a company whose value placed on the market at $13 and change per share is about $2
billion. $2.1 billion. And to give you some context around that, Warner Brother Records just sold for $3.3 billion. And this is a record company, one of the top four record companies in the world that's been around for decades, $3.3 billion. And this company, Pandora, been around for like 10 years, $2.1 billion.
So you're saying they're a joke or they don't? I mean, do they have any revenue? I mean,
no, it's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. And they do have revenue. They do have commercials that, yeah. And they do have subscription fees. So they are making money and they're just about breaking even. But the question is, will they ever be able to play in the Wall Street game? I don't know about that. Are they going to be able to increase revenue quarter after quarter? I just don't see it.
And do our fans care? Why do we care about Spotify and Pandora and all this confusing coming and going?
Well, because
it means more options for them as far as people who are players in the streaming music world.
Right, but I guess it's more a matter of which one do you go with? Which one's better than the other? Which one will last? You know, because only a few of these will last. At some point, some of these will go away.
That's true. And you know where I'm going to stick to get my music from? I'm going to stick with television the way God intended.
What?
Well, that's where, you know, I grew up watching MTV. I would get a lot of music tips from there. I never really listened to the radio because I grew up in South Florida. And now the way a lot of people find music and discover it is watching TV shows, songs used on Grey's Anatomy or, you know, whatever the latest CW show is. And of course, Glee, where they're performing music every week.
Yeah. And, you know, we just talked about Nick Harcourt being a music supervisor for such shows. You know, that's what he went off to do, whether it's Grey's Anatomy or other shows. Glee is going to have, I guess, six new writers joining the show for the third season. Now you'd think, well, okay, how many writers did they have before? Most shows have a writing room and a writing staff of, you know, 12, 13, 14 people, even more sometimes. But Glee, for the first two seasons, all 22 episodes last season were written by three people.
So they're tripling their writing staff.
Well, yes, exactly.
Right. So this is big news. And this is a show that I think has been very, very spotty quality wise. One week they'll have a great show. The next week they'll have a very poor show. So I think this is great news to sort of bump up the quality of the show. It helps to be able to, you know, pass around all the burden. You know, if they've got nine people working on episodes rather than just the three, Ryan Murphy, Brad Falchuk and Ian Brennan, you've got a lot better chance of maybe having a consistent, strong show throughout the entire season rather than tuning in one week and going, that was great, and tuning in the next week and going, hey.
Right, and the problem that you had is 22 episodes, they were directing some of them, that threesome. So they'd be writing and directing and trying to juggle the choreography.
Well, musicals,
and
they're incredibly complicated.
Yes, exactly, and they're doing a summer concert tour and a live 3D film, and it's just, it gets to the point where you don't have time to make it good. You just have time to make whatever you have to push out next. So having six new writers, especially some writers that, you know, they've written for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Mad Men, Private Practice, and Grey's Anatomy. These are people that know what they're doing. They've been around the block a time or two in the television writers' room.
Well, I know the cast is involved in the summer tour and other people are directing a 3D movie. I don't know that these guys have any active role in the concert or the tour.
Ryan Murphy does.
In anything other than a
artistic
executive producer capacity? Is he directing the film?
I can't say. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't think he has any particular role in the tour. I mean, other than the fact that it's happening, I don't see him as having a he doesn't have a directing credit on it. So I don't think that's been a distraction for them.
No, I don't know.
Doing the show is plenty of work enough. The interesting thing, the real news here, which might be important to fans, is the comment that Ryan Murphy made. And that was what he said, that in season three, they're going to focus on more new freshman characters.
Yes, that was kind of a big deal. No pun intended, and I'm not trying to move us along to big deal or big whoop.
You know, one thing you're looking at the show is these kids are getting old, and they're already like junior seniors. They're already clearly next year should be senior year for them. You know, Leah Michelle and some of the others, they've got to keep working in new characters, and they are working in new characters. I mean, they've hired people like Court Overstreet, who, you know, was going to be a big character, but he got sort of overshadowed by Darren Criss. But they clearly have, you know, pretty actively kept threading in new kids. And I think if the show's going to continue past 3 or 4 years and not look silly, they have got to get new kids in there unless they follow them to college.
Yeah.
But this will be great because, you know, they've probably run out all the variations they can on Quinn and Rachel's love triangle with what's his name?
You're asking me? You're kidding, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, so they've got their love triangles and quadrangles, and they've fallen in out of love 3 or 4 or 5 times. So keep bringing in new characters, keep bringing in new kids and new talent. Wow us with some new singers. And that's a great way to keep the show fresh and make it last longer than 3 years.
So is, you know, bringing Gwyneth Paltrow back. Those are the only episodes I've ever really watched. But now, speaking of musicals, a musical that we have been talking about on this show for at least 2 years. In fact, we once had John Horn from the Los Angeles Times on to talk about the, I guess, secret footage of the show that he saw. That Julie
that was
Taymor
screened showed. Screened for investors.
Yes. He saw this footage and came on the show to talk about it and what he thought of Spider-Man.
Say the name.
Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, finally opens. Finally. After the longest preview run in history, after all the major critics decided audience deserved a report on what the show was, like, I don't know, months ago, it really opened.
That was June 14th, I believe. It finally opened last Tuesday. I had to wait till Saturday to see the show. So, like everybody else, all I could do was read the reviews at first.
Right. And do you think that the reviews mesh with what you saw?
Well, I haven't read the reviews. I just read brief capsule predictions of, you know, descriptions of what the reviews were like. They were basically negative, and certainly I didn't think the show was good either. So, I mean, that makes sense.
So you didn't... Okay, let's talk about what you thought of the show. We'll talk about what some of the other critics thought of the show. What did you think of the show?
Well, I think from the earlier descriptions, the show was an incoherent mess, and I would say that the show is now a coherent mess. You know, it's got a basic storyline. It's easy to follow. You don't have all the elements that we were hearing about, like two big villains and a geek chorus and all this stuff. It's just basically Spidey and Peter Parker's origin story and a face-off between him and the Green Goblin.
So kind of like what the comic book was.
Yeah, the comic book were the first movie and a half, two movies. If you've seen those, you know exactly what to expect. Simple storyline, straightforward. Basically, the songs are no good. That's the biggest problem. The songs by Bono and The Edge are weak. They are not natural Broadway songwriters. There are pop stars who write songs about characters or write story songs, and you know or you believe that they could have a really good shot at creating a Broadway show, like Elton John or Billy Joel or Paul Simon. Whether or not they work or succeed on Broadway, you know they're that sort of writer. U2 is not that sort of writer. They don't write songs about characters. They don't write songs that are story songs. They write very personal, idiosyncratic songs that become anthems, but they are not story and character driven.
No, they're more like idea songs.
Whatever we want to call them. They're just not character based, and they don't push the story forward. So they're not naturals for Broadway. And in fact, you see the show, I would say none of their songs are successful. Not one of them is exciting. The only moment that had the best song in the show is Vertigo, the U2 hit, because there's a club scene, and for about 30 seconds, we hear the opening to Vertigo, where they go, uno, dos, tres, catorce, and then they go into that riff, and you're like, oh, wow, great, a real song. You're so happy and excited.
Which is actually the last thing you want in a show where all the other music is horrible.
The only other time you get sort of a jolt from the music is a few snippets of melody when Spider-Man jumps onto a skyscraper and he's climbing up and he's about to launch into his heroics for the first time. You get a pure U2 melody, you know, the Edge's classic guitar sound, that chiming guitar you know from the Joshua Tree and some of their biggest hits. And you get that jangle, jangle guitar sound, and the whole audience goes crazy for a minute because, like, for 30 seconds there, you're actually hearing U2, and you get sort of a thrill and an adrenaline rush, like, yeah, you know, here it comes. They do that very briefly in Act 1 and very briefly in Act 2, and those are the musical highlights in the show.
Did you like the flying stuff?
The flying stuff was okay. It was, you know, after the third or fourth time around the room, it wasn't so exciting.
Right, and I guess there was so much more of that in the original version.
No, I think they've added more.
Oh, okay.
No, they have not cut back on the flying sequences. They've added more. It's basically, if you've seen Cirque du Soleil, you've seen stuff just like it. It's kind of fun because it's over the audience. That's obviously very dangerous and difficult to do. I'm sure it was a technical challenge. But once Spidey's jumped around the room three or four or five times, you know, you've seen him jump around the room. He might land on the, you know, on the aisle in between people. That's exciting once or twice, but that's just sort of a thing. It's not really... it's not such a spectacle that it makes you happy to be in the room. Oh, my God, he went on a trapeze wire. You know, right. It's not that exciting.
Well, you know, according to, I guess we have a couple of critics here. David Rooney, the Hollywood Reporter, agrees with you. Significantly overhauled but still terminally clunky reworking of the troubled mega musical. Ben Brantley of the New York Times says this singing comic book is no longer the ungodly, indecipherable mess it was in February. It's just a bore. And Scott Brown of New York Magazine says, quote, Spider-Man has deteriorated from mind-blowingly misgotten Carnival of the Damned to merely an embarrassing dud.
Right. I would say that if you have a little kid and they're dying to see it, it will be painless. There are worse shows on Broadway even right now. It's not some god-awful, horrible, pull-out-your-teeth nightmare. It's just not very exciting or good. There are certain elements in the design that are really interesting. The design, the set, the scenic design, etc., that work and are interesting and are fun and are innovative and what you would expect from Julie Taymor, who did The Lion King. However, the costumes are a big problem. The costumes are kind of big and clunky for the villains. And the Green Goblin is supposed to be this big magnetic villain, of course. And he has sort of a campy, playing to the audience, jokey shtick that he has in the second act. You're supposed to be that lovable villain that you like. But his costume is so ungainly that he can't really dance or move around in the big musical numbers. So he sort of stands there and moves his arms while everybody dances around him, or he sort of trudges to the back of the stage. He's a very immobile villain.
So, yeah, I mean, what you're saying is exactly what most of the other critics have said. So you're not, I mean...
I didn't read them. I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, no, I'm not, and I'm not saying... I guess what I'm saying is it seems like what you're saying is the general feeling of those who have seen it.
Right. There is some interesting stuff in the look and the design. It's got a nice comic book feel at times, but the miking, the sound, and the songs are weak, and the story is just feels like a rehash of the movie, doesn't feel fresh to you. So it just doesn't work on about 18 different levels.
And then Julie Taymor showed up to the opening night. That surprised people for some reason. I guess it's because the surprise is if you get fired from a job, you don't show up on you know, when they launch a product.
Well, this is Broadway, and she has credit on the show. Her credit is original direction by Julie Taymor. Nobody has a director credit. She's the only one. And then it says creative consultant Philip William McKinley, who's, she's the last listed. Original direction by Julie Taymor. Book by Julie Taymor, along with two other people. So she's involved in this show very seriously. She wanted to support the actors. They invited her. They said, please come. And I think it was the right thing to do. Why not? You know, it's not going to interfere with your legal proceedings because, you know, they need to argue over who gets what cut.
Right.
But it's a Broadway. It's a big lovey-dovey world. It's a very strange world. It was a nice gesture on her part to show up. I'm sure there were hard feelings, and yet she appeared on stage to support the actors. And, you know, a lot of her work is there.
Right. And she then flew to Los Angeles and sat down at a conference and was interviewed on a panel. And she talked about it being very scary that the producers were kind of doing these focus groups to figure out what to change.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, welcome to having a $70 million budget.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one thing when you have like, you know, $1 million or less. It's, you know, you don't get a focus group for that. But $70 million, you get a few focus groups. And she
right.
also...
And a lot of Hollywood directors don't like focus groups. And certainly at a certain level, you should have more control over it. And you let them do focus groups, but you're freer to decide whether or not you want to use the info. That's sort of how it works in Hollywood. They're always going to focus group your movie. I think that's almost inevitable for every film, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think there are some films where even, you know, the filmmaker really is able to determine that. So a David Fincher film, yeah, the focus group isn't going to really sway anything.
Right, but they will still do them.
Right.
So it's not unusual that, you know.
Well, they'll do them for marketing purposes, you know.
Right, for marketing, if nothing else. So yeah, there's focus. Obviously, you don't want everything to be audience driven because they're not going to know what something new or different or bold is. That's her argument. You know, if you're doing something new, they don't know how to react. And so they say, oh, I don't like it. It's new. But then they learn to get to love it. But she said some silly things, too. She basically said that Shakespeare would have been appalled by focus groups. And I'm like, excuse me, Shakespeare played to the audience more than anyone in history. Shakespeare was there listening to every laugh and groan and sigh and knew exactly what was working and wasn't working. And I don't think he would have been upset by focus groups whatsoever.
And what did you think about what she had to say about Twitter and Facebook and blogging? She said, you know, she just couldn't keep up with it, that like people would come in and they Twitter and Facebook and she couldn't work with in a fluid live situation like that.
Right. She said, quote, it's very hard to create. It's incredibly difficult to be under a shot glass and a microscope like that, end quote. And she's talking about the Twitter and Facebook posting from day one of the very first preview.
Right. And I can understand her point, but she kind of should have known that.
Well, no, she has no good point. She's confusing what people are saying with how they're saying it. The fact that they did it on Twitter and Facebook doesn't change the fact that they hated the show.
Well, okay, you know, good point.
That's that she's confused. If she was working on the Book of Mormon or Priscilla, Queen of the Desert or Sister Act or War Horse, shows that got good and bad critical reviews but have been embraced by audiences, she'd love Twitter. She would love Facebook because she'd be listening to people saying, your show's wonderful. We love it. It's great. From day one of previews of the Book of Mormon, you heard what a great show it was.
Yeah.
So she's confusing how people are talking to what they're saying. What she didn't like was the fact that they said the show sucked and Arachne sucked and the geek chorus sucked. That was her problem. However, she may be trying to make a point that it's hard to work on a show that's in trouble when you have Twitter and Facebook and all that. And that's true. I mean, you used to get word of mouth. You'd hear people tell other people, oh, I heard somebody went to the first, you know, showing of this musical and it was a disaster. You'd get that word of mouth. Now you find it posted and amplified online. But you know what? If you make a change and it works, you're going to get feedback right away. Every TV show, every movie, everything that's ongoing has this issue. TV shows have to learn what to blackout and what to listen to. Sometimes, you know, J.J. Abrams said he was listening to people in Lost and they'd make a connection he never even imagined. And he said, wow, that's kind of interesting. And they would, you know, they could use that information. You know, there's good and bad about all these things. But, you know, the fact that Twitter and Facebook is there, it's not going to go away. And it's not a problem when the show works. Does it make it harder to fix it? I don't know. I think it gives you a really good audience survey without having to do an audience survey. If you go online the day after the first preview and see everybody saying, oh, my God, you know what? You've got a problem.
Well, ultimately, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, finally opening on Broadway, you'd have to say it is a big deal, even though critics think it's a big whoop.
Fair enough. And I think it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop. Isn't that what you're trying to say?
Yes, indeed. In fact, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Is Jennifer Lopez really thinking of walking away from American Idol, or is she just playing hardball to get more money? Lopez got $12 million for Idol last season, but only signed on for 1 year. Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, he's locked in for two. Now she's got her first top 10 hit in 8 years and movie offers and touring gigs and insists she hasn't made up her mind yet. Maybe getting closer to the $35 million Cowell, Simon Cowell that is, maybe getting closer to that figure would help her. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, she's an idiot because the only reason she has a top 10 hit, her first top 10 hit in 8 years, is because she's on American Idol. So she's really being dumb. This is a great gig for her. She should stay there at least 2 years. $12 million is a lot of money. If she can get a little bit more, good, more power to her. But, you know, come on. They've realized they don't need anybody. If they can get rid of Simon Cowell, they can get rid of Jennifer Lopez. And guess what? There'll be a lot of other big stars lining up to be part of the show now that they've seen what a good job she did with it.
Well, and that it can survive without Simon Cowell.
Yeah, and if it can survive without him, it can certainly survive without her.
Bye-bye, Borders. The troubled bookstore chain has a new date looming, July 29th. The chain has promised to find a new buyer by July 29th, or it will liquidate all its assets as soon as possible. In other words, the number two bookstore chain in the country is about to go belly up. And if they don't find a buyer by July 29th, that means I'm going to get even more email about deals at Borders. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, this is the second biggest bookstore chain in the country, and they're going to be gone soon. There's not going to be a buyer, and they're going to be gone. And Barnes & Noble's in trouble, too. It's going to be very, very hard to walk into a bookstore in a couple years from now.
You mean you can't walk into Amazon?
Not really.
Okay. The feature film adaptation of the Broadway musical American Idiot, based on the concept album by Green Day, is still in the development stage. But one decision is clear about the movie being produced by Tom Hanks and his Playtone company. Billy Joe Armstrong will reprise his role as the pusher St. Jimmy in the feature film. The lead singer of the band Green Day tackled the role several times during the show's run to huge box office and friendly reviews, so this is hardly shocking. Is the casting news a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I'd say it's a big whoop. I think we could have predicted this the second he did the show on Broadway, and then we found out there'd be a feature film. It was, you know, a given that he would play this role. The big question is who is going to play the lead role. That's one that I really want to keep my eye on.
A new Harry Potter book? J.K. Rowling is going to write a new Harry Potter book? Oh my God. Or as my daughters like to say, OMG. Wait. J.K. Rowling is not writing a new Harry Potter book. At least not now. But she did leave a trail of clues for fans, which spelled out the URL pottermore.com. Go to the site and you saw coming soon with Rowling's signature. Though the site soon crashed from all the traffic, of course. Rowling's PR agency said it is not an announcement about another book, but is a treat for fans, and they'd have to wait for more info from Rowling herself. I think that info is coming June 23rd, in fact. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a big whoop. It's maybe a game based on an online, maybe multiplayer game or something that she's offering up. It's fun. It's interesting how hard it is when you create a world to walk away from it. I see this with fantasy authors all the time. The guy who did The Wheel of Time, the guy who's doing Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin, J.K. Rowling, Philip Pullman. You create these worlds, it's very hard to walk away. It's such a, you've invested so much time and energy, it's hard to let go, and she clearly can't. I hope she writes some other new book some point soon. I can't wait to hear it. But I'm not surprised that she would want to do something creative involved with Harry Potter.
Yeah, well, you know, she did in talking to Oprah Winfrey at one point. They were both talking about how, you know, Michael Jackson could never get over he was always trying to recreate that success he had with Thriller, whereas she was confident that she would never find the success that she found with Harry Potter again in her life. Like, that was a phenomenon, and she could never recreate it. She'll never do anything that surpasses that. She just has to live her life knowing that and be comfortable with it.
And that's why I think she'll be okay, but it's still not a surprise that she would creatively want to keep something alive in the world of Potter.
No, writers gotta eat. Speaking of which, Matt Parker and Trey Stone have to eat. The Book of Mormon scales the Billboard charts. The hit, Tony-winning Broadway musical, has a reported $30 million advance in sales and is sold out until September at the earliest. So everyone who has to wait and see the show apparently decided to buy the cast album. It hit number 3 on the Billboard charts, right behind Adele and Lady Gaga, making The Book of Mormon the highest charting cast album since the original Hair back in 1969, which was number 1 for 13 weeks. The cast album sold 61,000 copies. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal, even though, of course, the main reason it made it up to number 3 is the fact that Amazon sold it at a loss for $2 a copy. That's when I jumped online and bought it. They had a 1 or 2 day sale.
Which they announced during the Tonys.
Yes, which they announced during the Tonys. And I bought it. I said, for $2, I want it. And I've been singing, I Believe and some of the more filthy-minded songs ever since.
NBC has its first honest-to-goodness hit in years with the singing competition show The Voice. But it comes at a price. Superstar judge Christina Aguilera gets $225,000 per episode, while the other judges, CeeLo Green, Blake Shelton, and Adam Levine, get only $75,000 per episode. Is this difference in salary a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. The numbers we're talking about are peanuts, really, as far as television is concerned. They probably knew she was getting a lot more than them, but assuming this is accurate and they're finding out about it, that can create ill will, and that can be a problem. They clearly all deserve a certain bump up in salary, given that the show's NBC's biggest hit in years. They don't want to pay everybody the same amount, I guess, but she deserves 3 times as much as them. They may not like that so much. So they need to somehow keep her with her star status, but also pay them more so they don't feel too shafted and keep everybody happy.
She was also one of the few, international phenomenons on the show. I mean, everybody knows her.
She's a bigger star, but, CeeLo Green and Adam Levine and, they're not nobodies. So, but it's always hard when you have a different salary. It can create a lot of ill will. You want to keep them up. Part of the show's charm is their chemistry and, the way they get along with each other so well. So you want to keep everybody happy, and it's a little tricky. And that's why this info coming out is a big deal.
Sony movies like The Social Network, The Karate Kid, and Salt disappeared from Netflix offerings. Why? Because cable channel Starz asked them to. In the convoluted world of rights holders, Starz had made a deal with Netflix that helped power that company's growth at a crucial time. But that growth was bigger than expected as Netflix exploded from 14 million to 22 million subscribers. Those subscribers scarfed up Sony movies and meant Starz reached a cap in online streaming of the films much faster than expected and had to take them down after Sony had a word with them. Now, everyone is, guess what, negotiating for more money. Of course. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's annoying to have shows be available and then disappear from Netflix or any other service that you have. It happens a lot, though. But I think they'll all figure it out and everybody will be happy and they'll keep it going because it's good for everybody.
The fairy tale story of singer Susan Boyle is headed to the stage. The YouTube phenomenon who shot to worldwide fame via the UK show Britain's Got Talent is now getting her own musical. Boyle's story from homebody to best-selling artist will be depicted in I Dream a Dream, with Boyle played by a UK TV star. The musical isn't headed to the West End or Broadway, just touring the UK and the US and Australia for the moment. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I'd say it's a big whoop. They're just cashing in. If it was going to the West End, then I would think it was more of a big deal. It's probably going to be cheesy and bad, but you never know.
Kind of like Susan Boyle's albums.
Exactly.
Charlie Sheen lost the latest round in his lawsuit against CBS. Sheen insisted he shouldn't have to go through arbitration and that he should get a full jury trial in his lawsuit. It's actually against CBS and Chuck Lorre for $100 million. Yikes. The judge involved sent the case to the official arbitrator for a decision on where the case should be heard. The arbitrator is widely expected to make a decision that, in fact, the arbitrator should hear the case, as agreed to by both parties in their contracts. Then the case will move forward. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal to Sheen's people. They would have loved to triumph, but it was a long shot that they would get to have a jury trial. It was always going to go to arbitration. So it's a setback for them, but not a lethal one. It's not a setback in terms of the evidence that they're presenting or the case that they're making. And that's what really matters.
Why film a music video when fans will do it for you? That's the idea behind the video Behind the Mask from the posthumous album released by Michael Jackson. The label posted a blueprint for the video and invited fans to shoot footage and share it online. Then the clips were pieced together to create a crowdsourced music video for the song. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a clever idea when you've got a big fan base. You can do it once or twice and get some attention out of it, but then it's basically been done. And so unless the video is actually good, it doesn't matter how it was made. The big deal is that, of course, this Michael Jackson album called Michael is already off the Billboard Top 200 charts. And considering how low album sales are now to get on the chart, that means literally nobody is buying the album right now. And I think that proves that we were right when we told people, yes, his classic albums will keep selling, but he does not have a rich library of songs, you know, of unreleased music. And that's not a good buy to spend a lot of money to secure them, because he's not a prolific guy and he's not going to have a lot of great stuff that you're going to want to hear years from now. So the money that they gambled on all this unreleased material was money poorly spent.
Skype is coming to your TV. The online video chat service and Comcast, the cable provider, plan to make Skype widely available to Comcast subscribers in 2012 so you can watch Glee and video chat with a friend via a picture-in-a-picture display. So it's picture-in-picture display, I should say. Comcast will provide a video camera to hook up to your TV to make it possible, which I'm sure they will charge you for, though apparently some newer TVs are Skype-ready and have built-in cameras. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal for Skype. They need to somehow come up with a business plan to make money. It's been sold and resold a couple times, and it's very popular, but it's not really making money yet. And making it part of your home life experience and making it as easy as possible to use Skype, you know, kind of makes sense. How often do you sit on your cell phone chatting with your friends while watching TV? I do it. So, you know, if the Skype was possible, it might be convenient and fun.
So what you're saying is from now on, you'll be watching TV as you record the podcast, since you do it via Skype.
And right, and apparently I'll be have to wear clothes while I watch TV now as well.
Exactly. You know what? Too much information. TMI. Well, after all those stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop, we had a lot of them this week. We're going to move on to Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss news stories each week that people in Hollywood might care about, and only people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, I guess it's people in Hollywood and China.
That's right. We've talked for a couple of weeks now about how China is a bigger and bigger market for, you know, Hollywood product, movies, music, television, everything. And we've got a string of stories connected to this.
Right. Well, the first is, well, I guess really, I mean, we should maybe swap them around. Chris Dodd, who is the new head of the MPAA, former senator, he is pressing China to open up its markets. China has a quota, only 20 films a year from outside China will get in. Those 20 films, probably only half of them are Hollywood films.
What are the other half?
Well, like French and...
Really?
Yeah.
You think there's a big demand for small French films in China?
Who knows? I don't know.
Well, I assume most of them are probably big studio blockbusters. Why else would they bother?
Well, out of the $1.5 billion box office that China had last year, half of that amount came from those 20 films.
And how many other films are released? Do we know?
No, I do not know.
Yeah.
Be that as it may, Chris Dodd, when he took over in March, one of his big initiatives was Open China. And he went to the Shanghai International Film Festival and gave a speech there. And he actually compared it. This is typical Chris Dodd. I love it. He's very good at going back and researching things, but he goes maybe a little too far back. He said that the country's relationship, China's relationship, that is, with Disney, Fox, Paramount, Sony, Universal, and Warner Brothers, echoed the title of one of China's earliest films, the 1913 Shanghai-made feature, A Couple in Difficulty. And when he addressed CinemaCon, he went back to like a 1914 film. He kind of was quoting a 1914 screening in Hollywood. I thought that was kind of interesting. He says, if the argument is that China's not mature enough, well, that's baloney. He says, if Virgil was talking about Chinese culture in Rome thousands of years ago, there ought to be confidence enough today to make and export Chinese culture without fearing healthy competition at home.
I don't think there was a Virgil was talking about Chinese cinema.
No, I think you're probably right about that.
The big problem is that China entered the World Trade Organization, and typically you must meet certain standards when you enter the World Trade Organization before you get to belong. You have to meet certain standards. And unfortunately, they were allowed to join with the understanding that they would eventually comply with the basic standards of the WTO. And that was a big mistake, and I objected to it at the time. And what happens is, of course, now that they're in, they can drag their feet and do what they want, and it's very hard to kick them out again. And so China missed a deadline in March where they had to open their markets to more foreign participation in movies. And all Beijing said was, oh, come on, give us a break. It's really hard. We need more time. We need more understanding. You got to be patient.
Yeah, we've got to get all these, you know, disparate groups of people, you know, we have to get them to comply too. You know, it's not just like one group here in this country. Oh, actually, no, it is just one group here in this country.
Exactly. So that's a big mistake. And that can't be rectified by Chris Dodd, unfortunately. It's a shame because they shouldn't have been able to, join the WTO until they met the right standards. And they haven't done that. And they're not going to do that for many years.
Yeah. And then, you know, you had Rupert Murdoch kind of giving a jab at the same festival. He says that the China's exhibition industry has not been, quote unquote, has not been fully realized because the market remains so restricted. Well, it also hasn't been fully realized because they didn't build enough theaters, and they're building new theaters at, I think, what was it, like 6 new theaters every 4 days or something like that?
There's like 6,000-7,000 screens in China now, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked when I heard how many screens they were building.
Yeah, and of course, there's not just movie screens, you know, there's also cable. You know, obviously, you've got people on the coastlines of China, which there is a middle and upper class that's very healthy and growing. There's a couple hundred million people involved in that. And then there's another 700 million people in the heartland who do not have cable and do not have, there might be one TV in a village. So those aren't the people we're talking about. But it's already a pretty big market when you look at the couple hundred million people who do have access to modern consumer goods and to cable television. And Warner Brothers has got a foothold in the China market for cable TV.
Yes, they're doing, you know, this controversial films on demand via, you know, TV. And they're doing it. This kind of underscores the whole problem in China. Warner Brothers Entertainment will be doing this on-demand service.
They're making their movies available via pay-per-view and on-demand.
Yes, in the People's Republic of China, they're doing it through You On Demand, which is, it has an exclusive 20-year joint venture with CCTV 6's pay TV arm, China Home Cinema. Now,
what? It's just the Chinese.
The bottom line is, it is the Chinese video on demand. There is no place else you can go. It is Chinese pay-per-view.
Not. Yeah.
So the fact is, the government came in and gave a monopoly to You On Demand Media for 20 years. So now all of these studios, and you'll hear about, you know, this is Warner Brothers, you'll hear about Sony, or you'll hear about Paramount, they'll all have to go through You On Demand if they want to do video on demand in China. They have to go through You On Demand.
Just like they have to go through the Chinese government if they want to have their movies shown theatrically.
Right. They have to go through the China Film Company, CSC.
Right. It's not a true competitive market, which is why they shouldn't be a member of the WTO.
I don't disagree. But
but they are starting to make more and more of their own movies, of course. And that's sort of interesting. Perhaps the biggest director in China right now is Zhang Yimou, who made a string of great films and then tapped it off by doing the Olympic opening ceremony, which is one of the greatest Olympic opening ceremony in all of history, as far as I'm concerned. He spent several years working on that. It was just amazing. And now he's gotten back into filmmaking again, and he's got a huge project in the works.
Yes, it's a $100 million period epic, the most expensive production ever in Chinese history. And it's called The Heroes of Nanking, and it recounts how Japanese invaders massacred hundreds of thousands of Chinese civilians in 1937. I'm a little confused how Christian Bale winds up as the star of this film, but he is the first major Hollywood star to come aboard as a, you know, aboard a big Chinese release.
I guess he doesn't worry about his box office in Japan.
I suppose not. Or I guess he doesn't really worry about the fact that he's not Japanese or Chinese and he's starring in a...
I'm pretty sure he's going to be playing a Westerner.
Yeah, probably.
There were Westerners during, I assume this is about the rape of Nanking. You know, there were Westerners involved in there, you know, at the time. There were missionaries and other people and ambassadors and people. Well, this is 1937. Is the rape of Nanking during World War II? So this is an earlier massacre when they invaded mainland China. I'll have to brush up on my history. But there were Westerners in China, obviously. And Christian Bale is going to be one of the stars. This is now the biggest film. Just a year or two ago, China made another really big film directed by John Woo, who we all know as a Hollywood director, though he made great Hong Kong movies like Hard Boiled. His movie Red Cliff cost $80 million to make. Now this movie's costing $100 million to make. So they're starting to throw on some serious money for the budgets.
Yeah, and this is a co-production. So it's got financing from within China. It's got financing from the U.S. and other places. It's going to kind of reach out to for publicity. It's hired the London-based firm DDA. Of course, we know about DDA, Michael. They're also based here in Los Angeles. Anybody who's been to Cannes knows DDA. And they're really going after award season glory. They are trying to make this kind of a film that plays outside of China, not just in China.
And you know, The Rape of Nanking did take place during 37. So it was before World War II when Japan did attack mainland China. So that is, of course, the historical incident that they're talking about. And I've seen other movies about this, and then there were Westerners in those as well. So I'm sure there's an obvious and clear and straightforward role for Christian Bale to be playing. He won't be playing an Asian.
No, and you know, what's interesting, I've been a huge fan of Zhang Yimou for years, for probably 15, 20 years.
He's fallen on hard times. He hasn't made a really good movie in a while.
Right, and now he's making this film again. He's known for not speaking any English at all. He's been asked to make films in the U.S., and he has declined because he doesn't speak English, has no intention of learning English. He's talking to Christian Bale on set through an interpreter. And, you know, the movie opens December 16th, and if it succeeds, if it's a big box office win, not only in China, but overseas, then you'll see more and more actors from the West heading east. And so it's a really smart move for Christian Bale to say, look, it's a huge market. It's untapped. My face needs to be in their minds, in this audience's minds.
Well, I don't know if that's why he's doing it. I assume he did it because the project interested him.
Yes, but it's also a smart move career-wise. If it's a good
movie, it's a smart move. I don't think he's not going to suddenly be making movies in China all the time about Chinese topics with a Westerner stuck into them.
Yeah,
it's
good
like
point.
There aren't many Hollywood people who've made Bollywood movies. I'm not quite sure why, but they just haven't fit into that milieu. But you know, if it's the right role, the right project, great. But if not, I don't think he's suddenly saying, "Gee, I need something to look after my Dark Knight series ends. I might want to start making a lot of Chinese movies."
I would agree with you. I don't think that's what he's saying.
But, you know, he's an interesting actor with good taste, and Zhang Yimou has been a world-class director, and hopefully this will be a return to form for him. So I'm looking forward to it. And that opens December 16th in China.
Oh, okay.
Right, and basically what we're talking about is China is a big market. You want to have your movies there on film, in theaters, on TV. You want to shoot movies there. You want to star in them because it's a big market. There's a billion people there, and you want to be part of it. And Hollywood definitely wants to get into China.
Yeah, and it's really, really difficult right now the way China's set up. And by the way, here's that statistics. They are adding 3 to 4 screens a day, China is, to a stock of 6,200 screens. Think about how many screens that is. Like 2,000-3,000 screens a year.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Huh?
Well, I don't know. I just made up the math in my head.
Well, how many are screens are they doing?
3 to 4 screens a day.
Oh, a day. Yeah. So 3 screens a day. That's 1,000 screens a year.
Okay. So, well, you know, I wasn't too far off.
Yeah. No. I just got confused. Well, there you go. So China, the new Hollywood, the new Bollywood, the
yes.
new Hong Kong.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking more and more about them as the years pass. And in fact, we will be talking more and more each week. So you should subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or in your RSS reader or the Zune Marketplace. You can find links to subscribe on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to our social networking accounts, twitter.com/showbizsandbox or facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That is also where you'll find links to all of the stories we discussed in today's episode, as well as all of our past episodes. So if this is your first episode, try to catch up on all 108. We'd appreciate that. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, at least for now, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even leave us a voicemail. Feel free to give us a call, 888-567-SAND. That is toll-free, 888-567-7263. Michael Giltz can usually be found at the Huffington Post or on his website, michaelgiltz.com. You can sometimes find some of my writing at Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.